Welcome to the Central Seminary Podcast. Thanks for joining us today as we discuss biblical and theological issues relating to life and ministry. This podcast is a ministry of Central Baptist Theological Seminary in Plymouth, Minnesota. To learn more about Central Seminary, visit our website at www.centralseminary.edu. My name is Jared, and I'll be your host. Well, good afternoon. Here we are again with the Central Seminary Podcast. We're excited to bring you another episode, and today we have Pastor Dr. Matt Morrell with us. Welcome, Pastor Matt.
Thank you, Jared. It's great to be here.
Pastor Matt Morrell, as you probably know, is our president, also the pastor of Fourth Baptist Church here in Plymouth, Minnesota, in the building that houses the seminary. So today we are going to talk about calling a pastor, not whether you should or shouldn't call him pastor. We're going to talk about what does it look like for churches to go through that process of calling a new man. And this is something that's been a particular area of study for you. You wrote your thesis or dissertation for your Doctor of Sacred Ministry on this topic. We're going to get into how this has become an interest to you. But before we do, we always like to ask, are there any books that you're reading that you want to share with us today?
Sure, Jared. Thank you. I did bring two books with me here. I've been reading a book by Steve Vyers titled Loving Your Community. And just as a point of stretching me in my consideration of how we might connect with our community, often am busy the work of the ministry within the walls of the church, but don't always extend to our community as we ought. And so some real provocative thoughts and some creative ideas about loving our community. And then another book I've just acquired, have not read it yet, Letter to the American Church by Eric Metastas. And I have an aversion to addressing political issues as a pastor. On the other hand, the argument of this book is if the church is silent, then we are going to suffer even greater ways. And there's a lot of reference to the believers in Nazi Germany and some of the consequences of maybe their silence in that day. And so the jury's still out on my review of the book, but I look forward to reading this.
Okay. That's interesting, and maybe that will be another podcast episode sometime, because sure. I think I share your aversion, in a sense, to talking about some of those things. And I had people in the church when I was pastoring who would try to pull me along the other way. Well, Pastor, are you aware what's going on in our country?
Right.
And they wanted me to address things like immigration and even localized things. And I just kind of my view was, well, if it's in the text of Scripture, I'll talk about it. Sure. I'll bring application if it's in the preaching, plan that I have. But I didn't necessarily want to talk to it. But what's interesting to me about what you said is we had an individual in our church who grew up I think the individual's from Latvia and grew up seeing Hitler's regime and some of those things. And so this individual was a little bit more predisposed to calling out some of those things.
Sure.
And it's just interesting to hear the perspective of yep. individuals who've gone through that and who've seen that. And I think there's probably things we can learn from that as well.
Sure. Sure.
So let's get to our topic at hand, calling a pastor. And you wrote your dissertation on this for, shout out to Northland, where we both graduated from Bible College. And you wrote your Doctor of Sacred Ministry dissertation on this topic. How did this topic become of particular interest to you?
Well, Jared, so often things are born out of our own experience. And my personal experience is being called to be the pastor at Chisago Lakes Baptist Church, and then being called to be the pastor at Fourth Baptist Church. Now, in two occasions, I have been extended an invitation, a call by a congregation to shepherd that church. And in both cases, they were positive experiences. However, having gone through that process twice, I learned of the complexities and the dynamics and the challenges. Subsequently, I've had the opportunity to counsel multiple churches and their search or pulpit committees who have gone through the same process, as well as men who have walked through this process. And so a bit of a burden to help churches and pastors succeed in the process of forging that marriage between a pastor and a church.
Okay. Well, I looked through your dissertation a little bit this morning. There's a lot in there about background and some biblical content about what this looked like in the early church and how they called pastors and deacons and some of that, which I'm sure would be helpful to our listeners if they wanted to. I don't know. Do you make this available?
I'd be happy. I have made my doctoral project available to search committees, pulpit committees, or pastors. So I could certainly forward a copy of that to anyone who would be interested if it could be helpful.
Okay.
Sure.
But we're going to talk about the practical side today and maybe some things that you've seen or learned. And I'm sure not only just from your personal experience, but just being connected with a seminary and students and even a larger church in Minnesota, you've seen a lot of things and you've seen it go really well and you've seen it go really poorly. So I'm sure you have some good things to share. Can you just talk to us in general about what the process might or should look like when you have a church who their pastor just announced they're resigning or retiring or whatever, or that, you know, right after, you know, it was last Sunday was my pastor's last Sunday. Mm. And I'm assuming you probably have done some work before that, but you just found out. Yep. Now you have to do this organizational thing called putting together a search committee or a pulpit committee. Help us think through what are some good ways to do that.
Sure. Well, a flock without a shepherd is vulnerable to all sorts of threats, disunity, distraction. A congregation without a pastor is vulnerable to individual agendas and other political aspirations of some people within the church. And some people are hoping for future change. Some people are hoping that there won't be change. There's perhaps personal hurt or disappointment, fear, and so it's a complex of emotions and decisions. And what happens in the vacuum of the absence of a pastor, different people rise to the top and as natural born leaders, perhaps take initiative. And so I would counsel a church upon the resignation of your pastor or when commencing a search for a new pastor, it's got to be bathed in prayer. And I think that precedent and pattern is found throughout the book of Acts, throughout the New Testament, of course. And the congregation, the leadership and the membership needs to get together and just begin in a spirit of humble prayer before the Lord. Then I think a church needs to look to its governing documents, its constitution, its bylaws. For whatever is prescribed there needs to be the beginning point. Now, the problem is very few churches have a robust process that's articulated in their governing documents. It might identify the deacons serve as the pulpit search committee, or the deacons plus some members at large, or the assistant pastor becomes the interim, or there might be some initial rudimentary instructions given. But then beyond that, the devil's in the details of how you proceed. And so it's important early on. I think a church is blessed if there are other pastor elders there, perhaps assistant or associate pastors. I think a church is blessed if there are mature lay leadership that's there. A church is blessed if there is a seasoned veteran interim that could be appointed or named just to fill the pulpit and bridge the gap there while a church goes through that deliberate process. But it's an intense time.
Okay. How do you determine who should go on the pulpit committee? If your constitution, sometimes constitutions will designate, you know, consist of the deacons.
Sure.
Or sometimes they'll say consist of the deacons and, you know, two other people or whatever. Suppose your constitution has allowment for selecting individuals from the congregation. How should they go about doing that?
Well, assuming you're following those guidelines in the documents, the Constitution and such, I think a range of maybe 5 to 9 is a good size for a committee. Anything larger than that can become a monster. I think it's important to have a cross section of the congregation. I think it's appropriate to even have women represented there, mm-hmm. Older, younger, but in every case, mature believers that can represent the congregation and who are prepared to do the marathon of heavy lifting that will be required over the months to come.
Okay. How does a church go about getting resumes?
Right. Okay. So before the solicitation of resumes, what I would counsel a committee to do is to establish first a profile of what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. Before names are introduced, that always front loads all the emotion and the opinions. Before names, start with a profile. What are we looking for? And that profile might be built upon certainly the biblical qualifications of a man, 1 Timothy 3, Titus 1 and such. That profile could also be built upon some feedback from the congregation. And of course, every church is looking for a young man with 40 years of experience. Mm-hmm. They're looking for a young man with lots of experience and lots of education. They're looking for a young man with a wife who can play the piano and who's children are, you know, prodigies in various ways. And so the profile can become the impossible. Mm-hmm. But that profile needs to be established first. Part of that profile would be distinctives for the church. Maybe it's areas of worship. Maybe it's areas of Bible version, or maybe the doctrines of grace, or all sorts of theological and philosophical hot points that might be unique or distinctive to that church. And once that profile is established, here's who we're looking for, then I think you begin the solicitation of referrals, names, references, resumes. And it's common for us here at Central Seminary for churches to reach out to us and ask for recommendations. Are there recent graduates? Are there other men that we know? And we're happy to facilitate and serve to network churches with men that are looking. Certainly, everyone in the congregation has a second cousin somewhere that they would recommend. Mm-hmm. In some cases, there's dynamics if there's an internal candidate. What I would counsel a church, if there's an internal candidate, perhaps an assistant pastor or whatnot, that they go through the same objective process, and they not just be named as a successor, mm-hmm. but go through the process. So the profile is established. And then a process is established. In my doctoral project, I did identify a specific process that I would recommend steps to be taken.
Okay. Now, I want to throw us back to, I don't know, 6, 8, 9 months ago when we did a podcast together on, I think we titled it, The Great Resignation.
Yes.
Which, by the way, is still our highest listened to episode.
How about that?
As of probably 2 weeks ago when I checked. There's some other ones that are close, but
okay.
One of our higher listened episodes. And we talked about the difficulty that churches have in finding men, finding pastors. Has that changed at all since then?
No, I don't think so. There are more churches looking than there are men available to serve. And so we do have a crisis, I think, in the American church. Certainly in independent Baptist churches, the circles that Central Seminary serves, where churches are looking for pastors. There's a great need for pastors. And that becomes difficult because every church, again, going back to this ideal profile, we want a man who can walk on water. We're looking for the Apostle Paul to pastor our church, and that may not be the case. I'm grateful in both of my experiences as the pastor at Chisago Lakes Baptist Church and also now at Fourth Baptist Church, the congregation was gracious to embrace me and to follow me as their shepherd in spite of my imperfections. And I have feet of clay, and there are bigger, better, greater men than me that are pastoring across the country. But in both cases, these churches embraced me and followed me, and I'm grateful for that in spite of myself.
Okay. So what should the process look like for presenting a man as a candidate when you have someone that they've answered, you know, your surveys or your questionnaires, and you think this would be a good person to present to the congregation? What should that part of the scenario look like?
Great, great. Before I answer that, let me just insert one other thing. In addition to bathing it in prayer from the beginning, establishing a profile, establishing a process and working the process, you're soliciting the names and as a committee, you're working through those things. I think there needs to be frequent communication along the way with the congregation. A congregation is going to be patient initially, but they're going to be eager to hear. They're going to be asking members of the pulpit search committee, hey, where are we at? Do you have a name? Have you considered this and that? And I think regular updates to the congregation about the progress of the process is really good. But now, as you ask, the pulpit search committee has identified a candidate. And I would argue presenting the candidate to the church with unanimity. If a pulpit search committee, deacons, whatever the leadership team there is, presents a candidate to the congregation without that unanimity or solidarity, you cannot expect a congregation, the membership, to have any greater solidarity than the committee. And there are anecdotes I'm familiar with, churches who have stood before a congregation and said, hey, over the last 9 months, we've been working on this. We've got a candidate we're presenting to you. We voted 7-2 or 6-3, you know, 5-2. And so we're gonna toss them before you and hope that it goes well. There really needs to be a strong vote of confidence from the leadership saying, over these last many months, this last year, we're putting forward a candidate to the congregation that we have, you know, complete support of. And then the congregation can follow that cue. So now you present a candidate, and I think you want a maximum exposure as often as he can be before the church with as much information, whether that's in print, Q&A, preaching, meet and greets, hospitality in homes or other cases, because what you're doing is you're forging a blind marriage. And you're saying to a congregation, hey, over the course of one weekend, you know, we want to forge a marriage here. It's like a blind date, and it's a lot. Now, you as a committee member, or church lay leadership, perhaps you've spent months and months and months getting comfortable with this, and you've seen the other options, but I think you want to maximize the exposure to a congregation. When I came to Fourth Baptist Church as a candidate, it was a process over a weekend, a complete week, and a weekend. It was exhaustive, and it was exhausting. And two Sundays, with the intervening weekdays there, where we were in homes, there were Q&A sessions with every different group of people, and we really spent a lot of time and turned over a lot of stones. And that maximum exposure, I think, gave comfort and confidence both to the church and to us as the candidate to consider if in fact this was God's will.
Yeah, and I would point out with that the church you were coming to in that sense was a very large church, and it might not look the same with a smaller church where you're meeting with everybody. You know, you have a meeting with, you know, this percentage of the congregation on Monday,
yes,
this percentage on Wednesday.
Good
you have
point.
Had a lot of people to be exposed to.
That's
and
true.
So it might not look the same in a smaller town, more rural setting. I would definitely agree with you, though, that the more exposure you can get, the better.
Yes.
You know, we've all seen, or maybe even been in churches. I think one of the churches that I pastored, I think I only preached there once. And that was, you know, my first pastorate, and I didn't really know any better, but
sure.
At that time, you know, it was like a whirlwind weekend. You know,
right.
We have these whirlwind weekends. You come in Friday and you have a potluck on Friday, and then you have a, you know, grueling 3-hour interview on Saturday with the deacons or pulpit committee. And then you have another potluck on Saturday afternoon, and then Sunday you preach, and then they're voting. And
right.
It's like, wow, it's like, do they even know you to be able to, give a vote.
Right, right. Well, and in many cases, there is a vote of confidence, not just in the candidate, but in the committee and in the process that the committee went through. So that, for example, if I am sitting in the pew of a church and I'm called upon to participate in extending a call to a man that I've just met, I heard him preach one time, and maybe I shook his hand. What I'm actually doing as a church member is I'm saying I am trusting that the Lord is at work here through the process of that committee. That committee's been working for 9 months. That committee has informed us every couple weeks about the process. That committee explained that they worked through multiple resumes and prospective candidates. And now they are presenting in to the best of their ability the God's man for our church. And so I'm going to vote yes, because I trust the process. And I think that really serves a congregation well.
Yeah. And I would, you know, I had some recent experience. I won't overshare too much here, but recent experience with this personally. And because I was not pastoring a church, I was able to have a lot more exposure to the congregation. By the time I was presented as a candidate, I had preached there four times, been up there four weekends over the course of a couple months. And I really think if you're able to do something like that, it's ideal. Sure. And it's only going to pay off in the long run.
Yes.
I'd also say that when it comes to maybe you're the church that the pastor is leaving to, or thinking of leaving, and he's candidating somewhere else, I think sometimes we hold our pastors too tight in the sense that our pastors might be afraid to even tell anybody. And so they mask it under the guise of I'm going away on vacation, which could be true. Not saying they're being disingenuous, but maybe they haven't told anybody they're looking. And they can only get away for that 1 week to do a weekend candidate and see what happens. And I just kind of feel if your pastor is too afraid to let the cat out of the bag that God might be doing something in his heart and doesn't want anyone to know, then maybe you hold your pastor too closely.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you have some thoughts on that, because I know coming from Chisago to Forth, you know, in many senses, sister churches, long connection between the two. Did you tell anybody?
Sure.
That you were looking? I know everyone's going to have a different view in this.
No, this is good. Jared, no, this is good, because this now being the flip side, we've spent our time here talking about the pulpit search committee, but for the candidate, for the individual, when I was first approached by the pulpit search committee of Fourth Baptist Church, as I was pastoring at Chisago Lakes Baptist, I had no interest in this opportunity, because we were so happy at Chisago Lakes Baptist. We were not looking for a change, and so when we were approached initially, there was an aversion to that opportunity, but we agreed to pray about it. Of course, over the course of weeks and months, the Lord turned our heart and really revealed his will to us regarding that. But that was a private matter that I had to agonize through individually, and then I shared it with our pastoral staff, then I shared it with our deacons, and then I, of course, had to inform the congregation. I underestimated the impact of that announcement. And my intent, of course, was not to hurt or betray a church, but I underestimated and then discovered there was a genuine love and affection that the church had for me. And I'm so blessed by that. But that's a very difficult judgment call to make when you would make that a matter of public awareness. I did have a very provocative conversation with a church member at the time who asked me, "Pastor Matt, how will you know if it's God's will for you to go pastor another church?" And my answer was, "Well, I will trust the Lord to confirm his will by the vote of that calling church." And I will wait upon the Lord, and I will accept the vote of that calling church. And the gentleman asked me, "Why does that church get to vote to call you? Why don't we get to vote to release you?" And I didn't have a good answer for that. And his argument was, "We've known you for these years, 10 years in that case. You're part of us. And why would you trust God to reveal his will through a group of strangers at the calling church and not through a group of your own your own church? And I didn't have an answer for that. In fact, I think, though, in history, I think it was common, maybe among the Puritans and such, for a church to release their pastor for some new ministry assignment, mm-hmm. going to the mission field, perhaps commissioning him to do that, or to make a move. And so that's something that maybe yet needs to be explored. Of course, in you know, two churches' case, they're perhaps both going to vote you know, for their own purposes. But that's a delicate thing, and I lament perhaps the hurt that I caused when I did inform people, hey, I'm looking to make a move, and I asked the church that they would pray with us that God's will would be made clear in this matter, as we then spent a few weeks in limbo.
Yeah.
And Chisago Lakes Baptist Church was gracious to me, Fourth Baptist Church was gracious to me, and so I'm grateful for the maturity of believers on both sides of that equation, you know, in accepting God's new assignment for me there.
Yeah, I know of one pastor who, when he started to feel like God was doing something, mm-hmm. and he started to put the feelers out there, he told some people, I don't know how broad the circle was, but he told some people at the church and was able to use them as kind of his prayer warriors.
Sure.
And support a pastor. You know, God's doing something in your heart. We want to support what God might be doing. And I think that was a positive experience for him. Now, he would admit he didn't do it that way in every church.
Sure.
But that's attractive to me. It's abnormal.
Yeah, understood.
But, and maybe we need to do better as churches to create an area where our pastor, as part of our body, can share that God's stirring something in his sure. heart, and he doesn't have to worry about getting fired because of it.
Right, right, know? Right. Understood.
To flip back, just a few more, maybe some shotgun questions relating to practical considerations for churches in this process. You have these questionnaires, candidate questionnaires.
Yes.
How much of those should be released or given to the congregation? I've seen some myself on the search side
yep.
where questions were asked and the pastor shared or potential pastor shared some very intimate details about his personal struggles or spiritual life, and not really something you would want to spread to the congregation. How do you make that determination, what to release, what to share?
Well, and again, that's going to be judgment calls, wisdom issues. There's certainly conversations behind closed doors, verbally or in print, that may be reserved for the committee or for leadership. On the other hand, in the interest of full disclosure, I think it is so healthy if a public search committee can communicate to the congregation, this is our candidate, and these are his positions on, again, pick your issues, right? Mm-hmm. And this is consistent with where we're at as a church, our church doctrinal statement, perhaps our philosophies in other areas. I think an opportunity for a Q&A or a presentation for the candidate to express to the congregation. We can't be exhaustive. We've got an hour time, or we have 2 hours. We can't be exhaustive and turn over every stone, but categorically, here's where I'm at in different areas of theology and philosophy. I think full disclosure can serve a church well.
Okay. I've seen other opinions on that, mm-hmm. where the pulpit committee in one scenario, I think the chairman of the pulpit committee was a hiring manager at his work.
Okay.
And from a business side of it, he looked at it as the congregation has commissioned us to get this task done. And when I hire people at work, I don't bring the whole spread of everyone in to see how they think they'll do. It's me and maybe an HR manager or sure. someone like that. And so they were a little bit more closed.
Sure.
And they thought, well, if you have a question, he's right there. You can go ask him.
Sure. Well, and another dynamic is one's church polity. Mm-hmm. You know, to what degree is congregational government, which is what I would embrace, to what degree is there elder rule? And again, what do the governing documents of your church, you know, allow? But there are different approaches. And in all of these things, these are wisdom issues and judgment mm-hmm. issues. There's not an explicit biblical prescription. You know, we don't have apostolic succession. We don't have apostolic appointments. And so, again, bathing it in prayer and the safety of a multitude of counselors. And it's a delicate thing. It can be a crisis point for churches. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I think I should say that maybe make the disclaimer that we're not trying to be reductionistic. There's so much more we could say.
Yes.
Especially when it comes to the biblical side, biblical principles. You mentioned bathing it in prayer. Yep. There, we could talk about qualifications. And so as we switch to maybe some thoughts for the pastor who's looking at a church, let's take this time to say we're not intentionally being reductionistic. We are just because of the nature of you know, a podcast.
Right.
But there's so much more we could say. There are biblical principles we could lay out, what to look for in a pastor, those sort of things, and we're just not not doing those today. So most of our discussion so far has been on the church side. What should churches do? How should churches set up things, the committees, those sort of things? But I do want to take some time to think about the reverse and maybe talk about some questions for a pastor who's looking, maybe a pastor who's in the process of candidating at a church. First of all, how should that individual prepare for contact with churches? Maybe you have someone who's a recent graduate from Central Seminary.
Yes.
Or you have someone who has been at a church for, you know, 15 or 20 years, and he has, you know, been in one place for a while, hasn't done a lot of searching, and now he's thinking God might be leading him in other directions. How do they prepare for contacting and reaching out to churches?
Sure. Well, certainly, it's helpful if a man is clear on his own conscience and convictions regarding issues. I mentioned a few. We could mention other issues, divorce and remarriage, church polity, worship styles, Bible versions, the doctrines of grace. So many of these types of things that are hot button issues. And so a man, whether a recent seminary graduate or a seasoned pastor, has to have clarity for himself and so that he can communicate with a pulpit committee in a church regarding those things. And that's him presenting himself to them. But then they are presenting themselves to him. And ironically, often it's disproportionately weighted where the church is interviewing the candidate and the candidate doesn't get the same or equal opportunity to interview the church.
Yep.
Where is the church on some of these very same issues? What is the history of the church? What are the what's the vision of the church? Core values of the church, mission statement of the church, and so I would encourage a candidate to ask his 20 questions, the proverbial 20 questions, so that he can fully appreciate what he'd be getting himself into. It's an unfortunate thing if a pastor accepts the call to a church and a year in he says, "Boy, I didn't realize that this was a thing," and now it's a point of conflict or disagreement. Ultimately, you can't probably know what you don't know, but I would encourage a candidate to inquire about as much as possible.
Yeah, that was the next item on our bullet point here. You know, I always felt like, well, if you're going to grill me, you know, for 3 hours in this interview, or if you're going to give me a list of questions that I'll end up writing, you know, 20 pages to, I'm going to put you through the same process and I'm going to ask you questions. And I've done that. I've had a list of questions where I wanted to know what their thoughts are on certain things. And they either wrote down answers or we sat down and talked about them. And I think that's important. Some other practical things, and maybe some of this is self-explanatory. Resume, of course, doctrinal statement, have that available. Sometimes that might be something that you have to dust off the cobwebs because, you know, well, I prepared it in seminary 20 years ago and haven't looked at it since, or whatever.
Right.
But that's one of them. One thing that I found helpful, and another pastor had recommended this, and I built mine based off of his, was a list of anticipated frequently asked questions.
Sure.
And I prepared a document that I would submit to churches that I think it was like 10 or 15 pages long, maybe too long, but I wrote down my thoughts on the type of stuff churches tend to ask, whether it was Calvinism, Arminianism, whether it was, you know, worship style or preferences, whether it was divorce or remarriage.
Sure.
And I would just write this down and send it with my resume and doctrinal statement. And that saved, I think, a lot of time.
I think that's a great idea. Absolutely. Tremendous idea to preemptively present those things.
Because if they see that and they say, oh, he's okay with this, and no.
Right.
Well, that saves me. Before I even fill out their questionnaire,
sure,
they can see what I'm all about, and they can say, well, yes or no, and it's good. Helpful.
Good.
So you mentioned questions that, to ask questions, do you have any certain type of questions that come to mind that you think are important to ask?
Yes, I think a lot of questions are going to be unique to one's experience. There's going to be questions of material provision. There's going to be questions of doctrinal and philosophical alignment. There's going to be questions of history. Why did the previous pastor depart? Under what terms and circumstances? Mm-hmm. Church polity and governance, those types of things probably can be discerned in part from the church constitution and bylaws. But more often, there's a culture that has to be discerned.
Yeah.
And so you want to ask those questions. I think in all of these things, you talk about we don't want to be reductionistic. Another disclaimer I would say in all of this is an imperfect process with imperfect people. Mm-hmm. And the committee is going to ask you loaded questions. And you're going to ask them loaded questions. And there's going to be backstory behind every talking point and every consideration. And so I think we need to give one another space and grace and always remembering, prayerfully remembering, we're trying to forge a marriage here, discerning God's will for the sake of his church. And when God blesses that process and puts it together, it's a beautiful thing. The church is his organism. He's ordained it, and you and I, we love the church, obviously. But things are going to be imperfect at best. And so, you know, when you ask a question and the answer maybe is less than ideal or different from your experience, it's okay. Mm-hmm. The church still needs a pastor, and you're still looking to pastor a church, and so the Lord can be in that. And then you'll have to weigh through. There may be a deal breaker,
yeah,
you know, and there may be something that's absolutely intolerable. And so you can graciously decline and say, you know, I'm not sure that this is a good fit.
Yeah, I think that's exactly where I would go. I think Kevin Bowder on one of our first podcast episodes talked about there are tolerable evils and there are intolerable evils.
Yes.
Certain things you can work with. And so make a list, figure out what are those things that this is a deal breaker for me. They may have sure. their own deal breakers.
Right.
But you have your deal breakers as well. Right. I always like to ask questions. The three main items for me was, first of all, what is the interplay between pastor and deacons?
Sure.
And is it a plurality of elders, or is it single pastor led? Is it, you know, the deacons are called deacons, but they function as elders? You know, who wears the pants in the church? That those sort of questions.
Right.
That's important. The second thing would be the constitution, because those are the governing documents. And is there anything in there that you, A, can't abide under, mm-hmm. or B, that you think, well, I can be okay with it, but it might be something to change in the future?
Yes.
And I always tried to have those discussions up front. You know, hey, guys, you know, this, I'm a little uncomfortable with this. You know, I can wait it out for a little bit.
Sure.
But, you know, I could see us changing this in the future. And then the third is probably the most obvious, but worship style. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have your first Sunday where you lead the congregation in a certain song and half the people leave because I can't believe he sang that song. You know?
Right.
That's a hard start.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a hard start. So when you think about the candidating process, the congregational vote, how do you factor in what the vote is and what you should hope for? Is there a percentage? Is it percentage based? What should you be looking for when you get the call from the chairman of the pulpit committee and says the church voted to call you and it is this percent?
Right, right. Most Baptist church constitutions have a threshold of maybe 75% as necessary to extend a call to a pastor, which is north of what it takes to name a new president in our country, right? You can become president with a much smaller majority there.
And you could also, most churches, be dismissed with a less smaller majority.
Okay, fair enough.
Many churches you can be dismissed with like a 50% vote or something
sure.
like that.
Sure, okay. So the 75% is a threshold. Certainly any candidate would hope for 100% vote. That's pretty rare and unique. I think I would encourage a candidate, if you are confident that God is leading and directing you to this ministry, then whether the vote is 85% or 95%, maybe immaterial. If the Lord were calling you to some mission field and you're convinced that that the Lord is calling you to the heart of Africa, there's no vote to give you any human assurance that you should go. You're going maybe to the face of an indigenous group that doesn't even want you there at all. Mm. But that the strength of that conviction compels you to go. And so if a candidate says, the Lord is in this, and I feel called to shepherd this church, one could argue for 75%, 85%, or 95%. Mm. If the vote is less than one was hoping for, I would lean on the leadership, and I would ask the leadership, is there solidarity among the deacons, among the committee, among the lay leadership there? Because solidarity among the leadership, I weight more heavily than I do a specific number. I think the size of the congregation makes a difference. If it is a small congregation, a single family voting negatively can skew those numbers. So the percentage of the call might be lower because there was that one extended family that was contrary.
Yeah.
In a larger church, so you may have a half a dozen people that are contrary initially. In a larger church, a lower percentage might represent a couple hundred people mm-hmm. who are contrary, and that's a hard start. So I think there's room for decision, you know, a decision to be made. I would support a candidate who says, I'm going to decline a call because the vote was marginal. Mm. I could support a candidate who says, you know what, the vote was marginal, but I'm still going to go. And again, recognizing the imperfections of all of us in this process, the inadequacies of us in this process. The truth of the matter is, a year or two into a pastorate after the proverbial honeymoon is over, mm-hmm. you probably are going to have a lesser vote percentage than when you first came. You know, you've done your dog and pony show, you wore your best suit, you preached your best sermon, you know, there's some enthusiasm initially, and so maybe you achieved 95%, but maybe a year in, you're back at 85% anyway, yeah. So.
That's a really good point. Well, I just have one more question. I thought I'd throw this out there. For the guy who is just starting at a church, and maybe he discovers some things that happened.
Sure.
And maybe it was in the interim, maybe it was with the previous pastor, and he wasn't there, but he knows of things. We've all heard of stories where, you know, a member who left because of discipline,
sure.
was allowed back in, you know, in between pastors, and everyone just kind of forgot that they had been under discipline. Or you have, you know, a deacon who resigns their position in anger and leaves the church and is suddenly back in as a deacon when in between pastors, yeah. and maybe there wasn't a congregational voting process to reinstate.
Right.
You know, you hear these things, and how much do you dig into that is what I want to know. And, you know, you could say, well, I wasn't there. Whatever happened, we're just going to move forward. I wasn't a part of it. Or you could say, well, in order to move forward, we have to take care of what's in the past. You know, whether it's maybe it's something unethical, maybe it's something unconstitutional.
Sure.
Maybe
sure.
it's even something unbiblical. How do you deal with that when you find out those things?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think these are hypothetical scenarios. These are, in fact, real concrete examples of any pastor discovers pre-existing conditions. And I think whether it's a pre-existing condition, so your predecessor's fault, mm-hmm. or whether it's a new condition, your fault, or whether it's nobody's fault, the reality is that ministry is messy, and churches are comprised of sinners saved by grace, and so there will be matters that have to be addressed. Sometimes you know those things going in, and you understand, okay, we've got to correct or address a matter, material or spiritual, and I think then in counsel with leadership or the congregation, whatever is appropriate in the case, you address those matters, and we, may the Lord give us the courage not to shrink away from those things. Mm. I think I would encourage any pastoral candidate, if God has called you to pastor, and if you love His church, then shepherd the church with all of its warts and scars and pre-existing conditions. Love those people and lead them forward to maybe a better circumstance or a better place, because every church has problems, and some of them are in the closet, under the, you know, under the table, or hidden or unknown. But as the Lord brings those things to light, I think you can shepherd a church through that. Maybe okay. a painful experience. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there was, God forbid, some scandal, you know, that was pre-existing that will always be a cloud over that church in that community. And there has to be some remedial work or some mitigation to that. But God's gift to his church, I'm thinking of Ephesians 4, God has given pastors, teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, till we all come to that mature, full stature of Christ. And so if there are listeners here to this podcast that have endured through to this point, and you're part of a church, I would say welcome and embrace your pastor. Follow him. He is God's gift to you. If there is a pastoral candidate who has endured through this podcast listening to this point, I would say to you, love and shepherd your church in spite of its brokenness, for this is God's grace toward us all. And may God bless his church.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a good place to wrap it up. Do you have any works of God that you want to share with us before we go?
Well, I'm grateful for God's blessing on my family. I have two of my own children who are graduating from Bob Jones University this very weekend. And so a personal blessing as our family is able to celebrate with them finishing their course of study there as we're wrapping up of the school year here at Central Seminary, as well as at Fourth Baptist Church and Christian School. We're just grateful for God's provision in sustaining us, and we're going to soldier on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your time today, Pastor Matt.
Thank you, Jared.
Next time on the Central Seminary Podcast.
I'm sorry doesn't make it plain.
We are so good at wrapping things up in this Christianese.
Well, that's a very controversial issue.
What are some other passages of scripture that you might use?
How are you thinking, speaking, acting, and relating as it relates to God, as it relates to others, as it relates to circumstances?
How important is the terminology that you use?
I'm sorry that you feel that way is a very ugly thing to tell someone.
Do you think confession and repentance is kind of a lost art?
Pain has two sources, biblically. There is physical pain, and then there's spiritual pain.
I'm sorry you got upset.
I would have connected to the check engine light in the car.
You probably have a whole list of alliterated points somewhere.
I think what we tend to do is we tend to put confession and believe that that's repentance.
Look for our next episode on the Central Seminary Podcast. Thanks for listening to the Central Seminary Podcast, our instrument churches in equipping spiritual leaders for Christ-exalting biblical ministry. Since its founding in 1956, Central Seminary has sought to provide serious students of God's Word with robust theological education as they prepare for ministry. We have many graduates around the world who are serving in countless ways to spread the gospel and proclaim the name of Jesus Christ. Find out more at our website, centralseminary.edu.